Who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
His license to kill. And now they're taking and they're teaching and they're growing for life and they're setting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Glenn Carl, who is the author of the new book, The Interrogator, An Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And let me just touch on the latest story involving the CIA, and that's the arrest of John Kiriakou, who... I remember interviewing him when his book came out, and I don't know how he got into trouble. And one of the things I find extraordinary is how zealous the Obama administration has been in going after former CIA officials. This is the sixth government official charged with espionage by the Obama administration for leaking classified information to reporters.
It is a surprise, and I didn't know that there were six, but I and others have noted and felt that the Obama administration has been more vigorous or aggressive in this area than its predecessor, the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. Very surprising.
So I'm always puzzled, though, by why it is that the CIA is vilified in lots of quarters, particularly on the left in this country and around the world. And lots of things are attributed to them, which sometimes makes them sound even more skillful than they actually are, which I'm sure you'll agree with.
And no comment on that one.
But then, you know, when you think about Jack Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, mm-hmm. he said, I'm going to smash the CIA into thousands of pieces. But then he turned around and ended up using them with a vengeance to try and kill Castro. And maybe there was some blowback involved in that, and who knows. But the long and short of it was, he really used the CIA a lot. And then when Jimmy Carter, you know, he was elected at the time of the Church Commission, he came in vowing to rein in the CIA, and then he turned around once he became president and used them. And the point I'm getting at is that the CIA is essentially the favorite toy of the executive branch. And during the Cold War, where the president, in dealing with the Soviet Union, had only two unusable and useless options. One was thermonuclear war or sending a letter of protest, a diplomatic protest to the Soviet Union when they misbehaved. My understanding is that the CIA filled in the enormous range between the useless and the unusable. And I find it very ironic that presidents get away with stuff that gets blamed on the CIA.
Well, it is the nature of the beast, really. It's an easy whipping boy because a politician will have to adopt and may sincerely believe the moral positions or postures that he takes in a campaign or in a speech. And one hopes that public life will be conducted according to the golden rule and so on. But in fact, of course, that's not the case and never has been in international relations. It's a matter of power, interests, and defending and advancing them. So intelligence work and intelligence agency is a critical component of any competent or functioning government, has always been and always will be, because there have to be options between doing nothing and destroying yourself entirely. And if there is a possibility sometimes of acting in a way that doesn't create a public problem and yet it does advance one's interests, then one will pursue it. So it's not a surprise that the CIA is always a central part of an administration's toolbox.
So we started out the program talking about Defense Secretary Panetta's press conference today, talking about budget cuts that aren't really budget cuts. And we also talked about how this new strategic national security landscape has so radically changed since the Cold War, where instead of national threats, it's unlikely that nation states will ever go to war anymore, and which is our entire history is about nation states and alliances of nation states going to war. That has suddenly changed. That's gone away. And then these subnational and transnational threats have emerged. And we've had all of these wars, which even though the military is basically still buying Cold War weaponry, the only people that are actually being used nowadays are special forces, more and more, and they will be more and more in the future. And they are very closely allied with the CIA, although there is this thing called Joint Special Operations Command. Mm-hmm. So give us a sense of what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the militarization of the CIA and the fact that they now the head of the CIA is this general who right. comes out of he didn't come out of special forces, but he certainly has been using special forces.
Well, over half the directors of the CIA in the history of the CIA have been from the military. It's always a phenomenon that, or a fact that has disturbed, I would say, most career civilian CIA officers who would prefer a civilian head either coming from within the ranks or from outside rather than the military. But that's a separate issue. The rise and fall, or the ebb and flow is probably better to say, of the paramilitary focus and resources of the CIA and its cooperation and work with the special forces of the uniformed services has always occurred. When I started my career, it was one of the heydays of the Special Activities Division and the paramilitary forces. That was in the early mid-80s because we were fighting the Sandinistas through our surrogates, the Contras, and also trying to defeat the Soviets through our surrogates, the Mujahideen. When those two wars petered out or ended for one reason or another, then it was no longer, and the Cold War ended, then paramilitary forces in the Special Activities Division were no longer the darlings of policy and the CIA, and they dwindled dramatically. After 9/11 and since, it has once again flowed rather than ebbed, and that has been the center of our activities and what seems to be the in thing to do. But it's driven by policy and it goes up and down that way. While the core of the CIA work always remains human intelligence collection.
Well, let's just touch on blowback because you brought up Afghanistan and the Soviet war and training the Mujahideen who Bin Laden was a part of that. And that's certainly come back to haunt us. I think, didn't the Dulles brothers start out, their notion of defeating Arab socialism was to encourage Islamic radicalism? Is there a history there that we use the green to fight the red and now the greens come back to bite us?
Well, it's no one can predict the future very well. We can be sure that there will be unintended and often unwanted consequences to whatever covert action that we take. That's not an argument, in my mind, to not engage in covert actions at certain times, but it's a very delicate thing to do, which administrations tend to presidential administrations tend to like probably more than career intelligence officers do, because we're more aware of the bad things that are likely to occur.
You're aware of the third law of thermodynamics, right? That for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
So, that's right.
Again, I am joined in the studio by Glenn Carl, who's the author of the new book, The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. And he's the author, of course, of The Interrogator and Education. Tell me about, the book itself is talks about this incredible struggle that you went on because you were involved in these CIA black sites and interrogating these al-Qaeda prisoners. And you knew pretty much from the outset that one of the guys that they thought was an incredibly high-value target, they had the wrong guy. And the more that you protested the kind of stupidity of what was going on, the more they adopted so-called enhanced interrogation methods on this poor guy. And that caused your conscience to have serious problems with your oath to the Constitution to protect and defend it.
It did. It was actually Kafkaesque, and I thought that I had entered a world of where the laws of nature didn't really obtain in a normal way, because I literally had the following exchange with headquarters repeatedly. I would send in a report saying, I believe that he has answered truthfully and he does not know the answer to questions X and Y. And the response was, the fact that he is not answering is proof that he is withholding information. Therefore, you are instructed to pressure him more. And I thought that that was just unbelievable because it doesn't follow sensibly at all. And I would go through the same argument again and the order would come back. And I concluded that I was dealing, I really did. I thought, well, the officer who's responding to me is a fool. But I was wrong. It turned out, and I didn't know this for years, that he was following his orders. And the formal doctrine of the Directorate of Operations in interrogations at that period of time for several years was the absence of an answer is proof of withholding information calling for enhanced pressure, which was insane.
So was this CIA doctrine being influenced by Dick Cheney, being pushed by it, or did this precede him?
Well,
because my understanding
right.
is that, you know, from people like Larry Wilkerson, who was, Colin Powell's chief of staff,
sure.
who was first to blow the whistle on what he called the Cheney Rumsfeld cabal, who enabled torture. What you hear from Larry and others is that this was all driven by Cheney.
I do not know firsthand if that's the case. That is certainly how I assess the dynamic to work. We, the CIA, the Directorate of Operations and the offices within that directorate conducting interrogations where I was working for a time, were clearly responding to the guidance and instructions and parameters set by the administration. There's no question about that. So Colonel Wilkerson's assessment is mine also.
So, and of course, Colonel Wilkerson sat outside on the seventh floor for almost 2 days with the head of the CIA selling Colin Powell the bogus intelligence on the Iraq war. And Powell kept saying, this is crap, this is crap. And Tenet kept saying, well, this is the best we have. And yet in-house, Tyler Drumheller had told Tenet that Curveball, the main source of the information who came from Chalabi's neocon shop, was full of it.
Well,
and was a nutcase, in effect.
Yeah, the agency had always been pretty clear inside, and I believe in our assessments to policymakers that Chalabi was not someone to be trusted at all. And the way he was became a phoenix-like figure was he had been rejected and rebuffed and turned away as someone not trustworthy by the CIA and the intelligence services, and then was picked up as the darling by neocon politicians. And politicians may speak with whomever they wish, and that's how the end run occurred that way. But the agency always knew that his information was self-interested and designed to influence, not inform, which is unacceptable for an intelligence officer.
Right, but why did Tenet set Powell up? Because of Powell.
Well, I don't think Tenet did intentionally, actually. And it is a mystery to me because I know Tenet some and I know Tyler Drumheller pretty well. And I consider them both men of integrity and their stories are diametrically opposed. I also know, I did not work directly on, at that time, Curveball at all, but I know that the hallway view within the Directorate of Operations of Curveball was that untrustworthy, unreliable. The dynamic occurred, I think this is important to know. What happened, and Tenet, I think, acted in good faith. What happened was the Directorate of Operations of the CIA said, Curveball is not to be trusted. We have doubts about this guy. But the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, said our assessment is that he is good. And there was a clash and there was it went up for adjudication essentially to the top of the CIA's command. And I think it was John McLaughlin, the Tenet's deputy, who said he had to decide somehow, do we use this or not? And I believe his decision was, this is a military-related reporter, informer, and the DIA is the military intelligence branch, and I will side with them and their supposed expertise rather than the Directorate of Operations, which is not. And Tenet then went with that decision, I think in good faith, and it was all wrong. And the DIA didn't really know what it was talking about.
Well, the DIA, though, and the Defense Department itself was pretty influenced by the neocons.
Absolutely. Oh, of course. Yeah. There's no question. But I think, yes, the answer to that is yes. Right. And they game the system, as right. happened over and over again. And now, in that specific instance of Kerbal, I was not firsthand involved. But I was involved in any number of instances when the dynamic that you touch upon played out. Right. And that's how the information was queered, frankly.
Right. Well, I looked into the forgery of the Niger papers because, you know, the whole Joe Wilson-Valerie
sure.
Plame story.
Well.
And nobody tracked that one. I mean, the amazing thing is that nobody actually looked into the forgery. They all talked about Wilson's, you know, fool's errand to Niger. You know, some of the top senior guys, Vince Canestrero, told me that they were forged, not by right. the Italians, but actually by the neocons.
So, well, I don't know if they were forged by the neocons, but they were certainly forged by someone who was seeking to influence American policy. I don't know what our assessment right. on who forged them was. But
nobody really looked into it sufficiently. And what was interesting was that Dick Cheney kept trying to sell these forged documents to the CIA.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there were so many different bits of information that one puts together to make a mosaic and then an assessment. The focus has been on Joe Wilson because of his article. And I've known Joe for 3 decades, and he's a man of integrity who told exactly the truth. I mean, that's just a fact. But it's also true, his was one bit of information. He was not a central player in the whole dynamic. What he reported corresponded and confirmed almost an infinite number of other disparate bits of information, all of which pretty strongly added up to there's no smoking gun and there's no yellow cake to be alarmed about here. The forgery, what it was, should not have been that fundamental an issue given the overarching effort made by the intelligence community that reached a clear conclusion, all of which was not congenial to the policymakers and so therefore was undermined and or ignored.
But the bottom line still remains, Glenn Carl, that we went to war on false, forged, and fraudulent information.
I would add one other thing, and sincerely obtained wrong assessments.
So, and just to finish up on Chalabi, Chalabi dropped a dime on this country, on the CIA, and on the national security apparatus by telling his Iranians, who he's always close to, he told the Iranians that the National Security Agency had broken their top secret code. I mean, it's extraordinary.
I'm not familiar with that, actually, and I don't know how Chalabi would have been aware of that if it were true.
He was told. Okay, I'll give you the source on it.
There's
a very, very good book written about it.
Yeah.
This came out.
We always thought Chalabi was
Arrows in the Night, and it really goes into considerable detail about.
We always viewed him as bad news to be avoided.
Right. But, well, Glenn Carl, again, the author of the new book, The Interrogator in Education. Glenn was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Your story is, of course, an uncomfortable story for both your personal story and for the agency itself. What's going on, though? Do they want to put it behind them? They're not happy about what you're doing, right? It doesn't sound like
the intelligence community,
yeah.
The CIA? Yeah, well, I think that's a fair statement. Sure. It's I write about a series of errors. I mean, I made as many errors as anyone in my career, of course, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's no dishonor in that. It's also a very delicate political and legal issue, that makes people very nervous, and that the intelligence community, the CIA, found ourselves in a position where we were explicitly following legal guidance and parameters that we demanded that yet clearly undermined our system of laws is an awkward position to be in. And my colleagues and I, from the outset, many of us were acutely ill at ease about the circumstances that we were being led into.
But the long and the short of it is it's all sort of been brushed under the rug. The president, who to some extent ran on the outrage of what was felt that the Bush administration was overstepping its executive authority. What an irony that the National Defense Authorization Act gives President Obama more authority in regard to military detaining even American citizens and even disappearing them, you know, all resting on the good faith of the President of the United States. You find that ironic? That Bush and Cheney would never have gotten, they didn't even ask for those privileges.
Right. I wouldn't use the term ironic, although I am ironic by nature. It's really disturbing to me that our fears continue to convince people that policymakers that we need to take measures that undermine the principles that we believe we are trying to uphold. I don't think the measures are necessary. They never are necessary, really, and they are counterproductive. I am surprised and disappointed.
Well, you know, you have to be reminded, I think, of Ben Franklin's adage that he who would choose temporary security over liberty deserves neither.
That's a quote of Franklin's I'm not familiar with, but once again, he's a wise man.
We'll fact check it later, but I think it's pretty accurate.
It is. It's one of the fundamental principles of our judicial system and legal system in our society is to err on the side of protecting the rights of the accused and accepting sometimes the ill effects that can engender or cause, because not all accused are innocents. Mm-hmm. But it's a better principle than to err in the other direction where innocent people might suffer.
Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you, Glenn Carr, again for joining us, the author of the new book, The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carr was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years, retired in March of 2007 as a deputy national national intelligence officer for transnational threats. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and production assistant Kelly Hargraves. You can sign up for podcasts at ianmasters.com and contact me there. I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.